From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Richard Lattendress of TVA Nouvelle. And we welcome Shayna Esterlin, Washington correspondent for I-24 News. And our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif issued a warning against those who might consider attacking Iran in response to an attack on Saudi oil facilities. The Trump administration sent mixed signals about what its response would be after U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo directly blamed Iran and called what happened in Saudi Arabia an act of war, while U.S. President Donald Trump expressed his hope for a diplomatic solution. With no clear winner from Israel's national election, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called for his main challenger, Benny Gantz, to join in forming a unity government. Tensions are building within the House Democratic Caucus over the Judiciary Committee's march toward impeachment, with Democrats again at odds over their messaging and strategy. Former Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski testified before the committee, and the contentious hearing yielded little information and left legislators considering a motion to hold Lewandowski in contempt and reinforce the administration's non-cooperation policy with Congress. The U.S. House Intelligence Committee held a closed-door session with Intelligence Community Inspector General Michael Atkinson as lawmakers hope to learn more details of a secret whistleblower complaint that has sparked yet another legal battle between lawmakers and the Trump administration. Panelists, welcome. And Shayna, welcome for the first time.
Thank you. This is very exciting. It's a Friday morning.
And we have a lot to talk about, especially with you. Your expertise will come in very handy here. We'll start with the U.S.-Saudi-Iran situation. Tensions in the Middle East remain strained as a series of drone attacks seriously damaged Saudi Arabia's oil production. The attacks are being blamed on a number of parties, and the odds of open military conflicts seem to increase almost daily. I'll start with you, Shayna. Obviously, is there any clarity on who perpetrated the attacks and why?
Well, you have Secretary of State Mike Pompeo right away coming out and saying Iran. Defense officials, we heard from them yesterday, there was a Pentagon briefing. They wouldn't go as far as blaming Iran, but they said there are a lot of signs that it was Iran. And frankly, the intelligence community and foreign policy analysts believe that Yemeni rebels, which is the group that took credit, they don't have the capabilities to have done that. So it's very, very likely that Iran was behind this. What's interesting, though, is to watch the administration change its stance over the past couple of days of how they're going to respond to these attacks. You had the president coming out initially with a tweet saying we're locked and loaded. You had Mike Pompeo saying this was an act of war. But Pompeo just wrapped up a trip to Saudi Arabia. On his way back, he really dialed down the rhetoric and said, oh, no, we're looking for a peaceful resolution.
And this is after the president, you could say, undercut his more aggressive talk, as you say, right as the attacks happened. So they've sort of stood out there on aggressive talk and then reeled that back in over the course of the next couple of days.
Yeah, well, you know, this is a president who does not want to get into a war, into another war.
For all the talk, he seems to be very averse to military conflict.
I mean, you have to look at this from a domestic point of view. He is running a campaign right now for 2020, and his base doesn't want another war. He knows this. I mean, he campaigned initially in 2016. I'm not going to get the U.S. into another war in the Middle East. So he does not want this. But Iran, you know, analysts say if they don't see a military response, they see that as a sign of weakness. And so they'll keep pushing the United States here. And the president's in a really tricky position. How does he respond if Iran continues to up the ante?
Let's talk about that, Richard, with the response of the American government when there has been a pledge. There have been open pledges to secure the Middle East and that allies would be supported and there would be military intervention if there was any sign of instability. This seems to be a sign of instability. If there is no strong action, does that compromise not only the standing of the Trump administration, but the standing of any peace process that might have hopes of going forward?
Well, it just shows once again that the administration is trying to figure out a way to balance the president's rhetoric and the totally absence of will on his side and his supporters' side into getting into a new conflict. So your question is interesting because is there at the moment any type of peace process in the Middle East? We are waiting for what the Americans have in mind for the Palestinians and the Israelis, but at the moment there's no other initiative. The only main dynamic is this maximum pressure on the Iranian regime to come back to some sort of discussion, negotiations, to figure out a way to recreate an agreement like the JCPOA, the agreement on the Iranian nuclear program. And at the moment, obviously, the Iranian economy is being suffocated by these sanctions. Iran is challenging the Americans with the and the region with this type of attack, if it's confirmed. But of course, the president has cornered himself into not negotiating until there's some lowering down of Iranian attitude in the region, which is not what we see at the moment.
Well, you raised a couple of interesting points. I'll go back to you, Shane. The president has said that he would talk to the Iranians without preconditions. And then that became unclear whether it was with preconditions and then not. We have the UN talks that are coming up soon with the opportunity there for the U.S. and Iran to meet. Will there be preconditions for that meeting? And what does the rest of the world want President Trump to do after stepping out of this agreement? What does the rest of the world want to see happen?
I have so many very good questions
Indeed, in that one question you gave me.
But I will say, yeah, there was this really confusing moment where the president came out on Twitter and called it fake news that the media was reporting that he would meet with Rouhani, Iran's president, with no preconditions, because his team, Steve Mnuchin, Mike Pompeo, they have been saying the president will meet with Rouhani without preconditions. So that was a little bit of a bizarre moment. The president has said himself he's willing to meet Rouhani. The problem is Rouhani is not willing to meet President Trump.
At this point,
you know, Iran has said, you guys have to lower the sanctions, you have to ease off the sanctions, and then we'll meet with you. But the Trump team's line here is, we're going to continue the maximum pressure until Iran folds and comes to the table. So they're sort of talking past each other. It's hard to see how any meeting happens, certainly not next week. But we also know President Trump wants a diplomatic victory, and the UN would be a great place to get that.
Again, where does the rest of the world fall out on this? Again, we had multiple players that were involved in an agreement that the U.S. and its in the Trump administration's America First policy, more and more it seems like America Only policy, like France. Would those other countries want to see the U.S. come to the table? Would they prefer military action, one or the other, more than?
Oh, no. They want a de-escalation of this crisis. When we're talking about the Europeans.
Yes.
The Europeans have made it very clear from the beginning, Trump should not have pulled out of the nuclear deal. It was a deal that was working. Him pulling out has really provoked the escalation that we're seeing in the Middle East right now. That's their line. They would love to see Trump and the Iranians talking. You know, when we're talking about Israel, when we're talking about Saudi Arabia, they have their own concerns here about Iran's growing power in the Middle East. They want to see a more firm line. But even the Saudis, I mean, this attack was on Saudi oil facilities. They seem to be hesitating to even fully saying this was Iran, because they may not want to get into a war with Iran,
right?
A war they really may not win.
Richard, I'll go to you for the last word on this.
Well, obviously, the Europeans don't want to get into a new conflict in the Middle East, but the Chinese and the Russians have been supportive of the Iranians in the entire process. So at the moment, the Americans and the Saudis with the Israelis are more or less on their side, and the entire world on the other side. And as Shana was underlining, even the Saudis are not really into getting aggressive towards Iran at the moment. So there's obviously not a big dynamic of starting something bad, except that Iran is trying to shake the cage of the sanctions that, again, is crippling its economy.
Let's move on to the Israeli election. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called for his main challenger, Benny Gantz, to form a unity government after an election that finished in a virtual tie. I'll go to you again, Shana, for this one. The two parties sort of give us the layout for what the election results were and what the immediate prospects are going forward. Really, in describing, what does a unity government actually mean? What is that?
I love Israeli politics because it's just so complicated. Every time you think you figured it out, you haven't. You know, it's not like here in the U.S. where voters vote for a candidate, you know, a Democrat and a Republican, and one loses and one wins. In Israel, voters vote for parties. And if a party doesn't get a majority, they've got to form a coalition. And that's what we saw in this second election, because the first election didn't really work out. Benny Gantz, who is this former military chief, the military chief of Israel's army. His party, the Blue and White Party, has a slight edge over Netanyahu's party, the Likud party, but nobody has enough of a majority to form a government, so there's got to be a coalition. Now, you see Netanyahu, who's in a pretty weak position here. He knows how vulnerable he is. He's reached out to Benny Gantz to form a unity government, which would be a power-sharing government. So maybe Netanyahu would be prime minister for a couple years. Benny Gantz would be prime minister for a couple of years. Not surprising, Benny Gantz said, no, thank you, because this has been a really, really ugly campaign. I mean, Netanyahu went personal. To be frank, Israeli politics are never nice. They're generally ugly, but this seemed taken to a new low. The other reason is because Netanyahu wants to include religious parties into a coalition, and Gantz does not. And so what we will know on Sunday, when all the party leaders meet with Israel's president, he will then choose who is the best candidate to form a government. And so we'll have a better idea of what happens next after that.
Richard, it seems like Netanyahu is one of the ultimate political survivors in this case. Are you surprised by him even pitching the idea of a unity government with a bitter enemy?
Well, he has no choice. He's trying to stay within the legitimate political spectrum because there is a corruption probe waiting for him if he leaves power. And so after that, the immunity, all kind of protection he could get from being in the Knesset or being in the government or being prime minister, all this falls apart. So it's a survival. It's like almost a, it's a survival with a capital S that's involved in his case in this situation.
No, personal survival as well as political.
Yes.
Well, we'll finish with you, Shana, on this one. The other parties who are involved, the geometry of it is very complicated. There's so many other little parties that need to be incorporated in order to make the needed majority. And so many of them are antithetical to what the other side believes. This is a process that's going to take days, weeks, or months.
Maybe months, because the candidate will have about 6 weeks to try and form a coalition. And if that candidate fails, the president gets to choose a different candidate. So we could be looking at this for a long time. But, you know, you also have to think about Donald Trump. It's not only these small parties that affect what's happening. Donald Trump has had a big effect on Israeli elections. Netanyahu really campaigned on his friendship with Donald Trump. It didn't seem enough to sway voters. And now you're seeing Donald Trump distance himself from Netanyahu, because we know Trump does not like losers.
Yeah, I think the comment was our relationship is with Israel, not with Netanyahu. With that, let's take a break and we'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Richard Latendresse of TVA Nouvelle, Shana Estelin, Washington correspondent for I-24 News, and our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Panelists, we're going to take this next half of the remaining show and talk about a few issues that relate to three topics that all have to do with the internal political storms that are challenging the Trump administration and calling into question the balance of power in the United States government and challenging the will and the skill, let's say, of the Democratic Party to respond in an effective way. We're going to start with former Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski, who testified before the House Judiciary Committee, with lawmakers focusing on Lewandowski's sworn statements in the Mueller report, saying that Trump asked him to tell former Attorney General Jeff Sessions to stop the inquiry into Russia's interference in the U.S. election and his possible ties to his campaign. I'm going to start with you, Richard. I watched the hearings. Was there anything that stood out to you about these hearings other than just the contentious nature?
Well, what stood out to me was how, in the end, inefficient the Democrats were in going further with the Mueller report. Having Corey Lewandowski on the Judiciary Committee was supposed to put some flesh on the bone of this report and put a face of the attitude of the president in the White House and the way he was dealing with this inquiry. And in the end, what came out of this was that Lewandowski made a farce of the whole thing, didn't confirm what we knew from the report. We didn't learn anything more. It's just a confirmation. The Republicans at no moment gave any credit to the hearings, And Lewandowski, now that it's over, came out of this as some sort of a hero for the opponents of the Democrats. So what good did it do to the Democrats who in the House are trying to find a way to go further with this impeachment process, since they have a majority of the Democratic members of the House supporting the process? I don't see it.
Your thoughts, Jenna?
It was a political circus, as you know, you guys have been bringing up. Very difficult for the Democrats to try and pursue this impeachment inquiry when the White House is stonewalling them. And it's not only this inquiry, it's really every inquiry.
As I say, this is a strategy. This is a thought-out strategy to absolutely be uncooperative with any type of investigation that's brought forward by the House or the Senate. The Senate's not doing anything, of course, but it's all the House.
Yeah, well, the White House, I mean, the position from the White House is that the House Democrats are obsessed with getting Trump out of office. And so they're going to pursue any investigation they can to make that happen. And it's all a witch hunt. The House Democrats counter, no, we're lawmakers, we're Congress. Our job is oversight. And there are a lot of troubling things the White House is doing that we have to, well, investigate. But especially when it comes to impeachment, you know, House Democrats that are pursuing this line, they're not only up against the White House, they're also up against their own leadership. Because, for instance, Nancy Pelosi, she's not really interested in impeachment because the majority of Americans don't support it, and that could backfire against the Democratic Party.
So the impeachment idea has, to this point, mostly been supported because of the evidence of the Mueller report, those sorts of things. That's sort of the basis of that movement. So in the face of that, you have the U.S. House Intelligence Committee holding a closed-door session with the Intelligence Community Inspector General Michael Atkinson. He was talking to lawmakers about the details of a secret whistleblower complaint that sparked yet another legal battle between the lawmakers and the Trump administration. I believe, Shana, I'll go back to you again. What were sort of the basics of this thing, this whistleblower complaint?
Yeah, it's all very mysterious still. You know, the information we're getting, a lot of it is from very good reporting from Washington Post and the New York Times. It seems to be centered around Ukraine, a conversation the president had with Ukraine's leader, where essentially he threatened, again, allegedly, nothing's confirmed, he threatened to withhold military aid unless Ukraine went after Joe Biden, brought up some dirt over Joe Biden, because Joe Biden, when he was vice president, he pressured Ukraine to fire a top prosecutor for corruption. It happened to be that prosecutor was looking into a gas company that Joe Biden's son was part of. Now, the Biden campaign counters that he had no idea that his son was mixed up into all of this. And corruption advocates say this prosecutor was corrupt. He had to go. So Joe Biden did nothing wrong. But that is what you see Rudy Giuliani, he's been pursuing with the Ukrainians too, is to get dirt on Joe Biden. And so someone was very troubled by this conversation that Trump had and filed a whistleblower complaint, and that's where we are right now.
And a whistleblower campaign, for those who aren't familiar with the lingo, is a system whereby a person who sees wrongdoing within the government can report it to a government official without going to the press, and it is supposed to be without any fear of reprisals in that area. So it's a very important part of government integrity to have this method for people to report things that they see wrong. And the reason I bring this up into the whole conversation of impeachment is because now, allegedly, the acting director of national intelligence claimed to have stopped the reporting of this to Congress. So if you have this, and that instruction came from the White House, does this give more ammunition to the Democrats?
Well,
there's a lot of ifs here.
If President Trump was indeed putting pressure on Zelensky, the Ukrainian leader, with the military aid the U.S. is supposed to give, over around $250 million to the Ukrainian, to hold back on this if nothing is done, well, there is obviously impeachable aspect to this, but there's so many ifs in there. What's interesting is this whistleblower system works if, in principle, the other steps are taken. In right. this very case, it was considered a urgent matter. The Inspector General of the Intelligence Community considered that it was important enough, went to the Acting Director of National Intelligence, who decided not to go to the elected officials, which is usually the normal step. So somebody somewhere, and we're getting closer and closer to the White House.
There was intervention.
There was intervention.
Clearly there was intervention.
Somebody has decided that, no, it was not urgent, but it's not the people who usually make these decisions. So this is why at this moment, and unfortunately we do not have enough details, but there's been so much good work done by the Washington Post and the New York Times that very quickly we've been able to figure out that the Congress has been kept in the dark on something that seems to be very serious.
So let's fold this back into the politics of it for a moment. So you have all of these issues sort of swirling around the White House and going up and down Pennsylvania Avenue between the Capitol and the White House. And the challenge for the Democrats seemed to be whether or not it's politically expedient for them to take steps forward. Should they take steps forward? And if they do, how will they have the mechanisms to compel witnesses to be effective witnesses if every witness called from the administration is going to do is simply stonewall their questioners?
I mean, and that's what we're seeing, especially with Corey Lewandowski and this whistleblower complaint situation, is that the White House is pulling out all the stops to try and stonewall these investigations. When you think about impeachment, it's a political move. There needs to be support for it. Even if one thinks that whatever Trump did is the most unethical thing imaginable, there has to be the political will to impeach him. And there doesn't seem to be, at least when we're talking about Democratic leadership, that political will. Yes, a majority of House members, House Democrats, want to pursue impeachment inquiry. But Nancy Pelosi, she has to look out for those Democrats who come from red states, who are very vulnerable. And if the Democratic Party becomes a party of impeachment, those red state Democrats could be in trouble. And she wants to keep the majority of the House. So that's what she's looking for.
You're absolutely right on that. Those are the Democrats that gave the Democrats the majority, those red state Democrats. Richard, I'll go back to you. Politically, again, even if it's a difficult thing to do, is it the correct thing to do for a legislator who's elected to protect the process of government?
Yes, it is the correct thing to do. But this is a dance that has to be done with a partner, and Republicans in Congress have circled the charts around the president, the White House, the administration, and there's no way to have them support what seems to be, for some people, a totally legitimate legislative process attitude. So my feeling working at the White House, Michael, is that we are getting into a presidential year, and this is going to be solved in November, on November 3rd, 2020, because the impeachment process can look legitimate to a certain number of people. The Republicans are absolutely not getting involved in there. You look at the polls, the Americans are not into getting into this process either. Over 2.5 years of the Mueller probe, in a thick report,
right,
full of details. And
great
stuff.
Book. Nobody read it.
Nobody read it. And just to end on this point, I was looking at the most recent Gallup poll. 43% of the Americans disapprove of the administration, but 91% of the Republicans like what they see. So why would they go against the administration or against the president or with the Democrats into thinking again what happened when politically it'd be suicide?
So you can read the tea leaves in the numbers and the polls and laid out a very good case there, Richard, for why the Democrats don't do it. It's a very good explanation. Could it cost the Democrats if they don't take action themselves? If you could look at the practical matter of it and say, well, we can't get a conviction in the Senate anyway, so there's no point in doing it.
I mean, that's what they're facing right now, is appeasing their base. The base is calling for impeachment, and then thinking about the larger view here of getting a Democrat elected in 2020 and not losing the House majority. So the Democratic Party is facing a big question right now. What do you do here? Do you pursue impeachment or do you not? Or do you sort of let the Trump administration get away with some of the more questionable abuses of power that we're seeing, alleged, I should say?
Alleged. Again, there's a lot of questions that need to be answered on this particular issue. I'm sure that the leaders in the House, as well as our listeners, will be interested in hearing the details as they come out. As we finish, just wanted to bring up a quick note of the last couple of days. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has been caught up in a series of situations where he was wearing what is known as blackface makeup in certain social situations. He has made apologies for it. I'll go to you, Richard, on this. Is this something that will blow over? We've had this situation with a number of U.S. politicians, and it seems to have blown over for them. Mm-hmm. Will that be the case for...
Well, it's going to be interesting to see, because we are in Canada and into an election campaign at the moment. The election is October 21st, so we're getting closer. Justin Trudeau was the darling of the left all over the world, and the hope of the liberals, as we say here in the U.S.
Quite ironically, the face of the liberal
class. Quite ironically. I think it has hurt him very much all over Canada. It doesn't have the same historical meaning as it has in the U.S., but fundamentally, it shows a failure of judgment on his part that unfortunately seems to be following him, will be following him for the rest of the campaign.
As I've said at the beginning of the summer, it's just remarkable to me the number of people who thought that this was a good idea at any point. And that list seems to keep growing as we move along. That's all the time we have for this week. We want to thank Richard Latendresse, TVA Nouvelle Canada, and Shayna Estulin, correspondent for I-24 News. The program is produced by VOA's Kim Lewis. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.